The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Okay, it is my privilege to be here, and looking around you, I'm a wee bit nervous because it reminds me of a time I went to speak at an art college, and there was a bunch of art lectures and so on, and I spoke about art and so on, and afterwards one of the lecturers came up to me and said, David, you're either a genius or you've got nerves of steel. And I said, why? He said, all the guys through there think you're a genius and you know lots about art. And he said, I think you know nothing about art, but you just managed to convince us all that you knew a great deal. And I said, it's the latter that's true. So I'm going to talk about some legal terms. And I realize that some of you go, no, that doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean that. So you can correct me. And that's how I learn. That's how I do things. I put things out there and I learn. Because I do want to look at evidence and proof, which is not normally associated with religion. You get lots of people say, oh, well, they're religious. And it kind of means a blind faith. I actually think that it is wrong to believe something without having some evidence for it. And I think that that is actually the Christian position. I know that's counterintuitive for many people. So I thought that what we mean by proof and evidence, they're two different things. In terms of absolute proofs, it is very difficult to absolutely prove anything. One of the things I like to do with teenagers is ask them to prove to me that they did not come into existence yesterday. And it's actually very difficult to do that. Any argument that you give, I can do that. I don't know if any of you in court have had to argue against a conspiracy theorist, but if you do, I pray that God would have mercy on you. Because conspiracy theorists, it doesn't matter what you say, they'll all say, ah, that's part of the conspiracy. And but proof in another sense, and I think this is much more in a legal sense, is this. Evidence sufficient to establish a thing as true or to produce belief in its truth. And that's what I'm going to try and do this week and also next week. I'd also argue that proof has to come to a standard. You're looking for a common standard. In law courts, if you have the judge has a different standard, if different lawyers have different standards, it just doesn't work. You have to have a common understanding. And I would suggest there are two things, two types of proof and evidence. One is beyond reasonable doubt. So you can have doubt, but whether it's reasonable. So you're saying it's beyond, that is a very high standard of proof. And then the other, which is, I think, below it, preponderance of evidence. So you could have a reasonable doubt about something, but actually the preponderance of evidence means that you would accept something as true. In terms of laws and rules of evidence, there are rules and legal principles that govern the proof of facts in legal proceedings. I actually think that's not a bad definition for what I'm going to try and do because, you see, we live in a world, and I think a lot of this is to do with social media, where people have their opinion and then they seek confirmation bias. They seek information that suits them. And anything that doesn't fit with what they already believe, they just exclude. So, I mean, I don't want to get you into this, but never ever, as a golden rule, never ever argue about something like Brexit on the internet. Because those who are for it will find all the information they want for it, those who are against it. And it's the same with many other issues. Here in New South Wales, the abortion debate at the moment. Generally, it's not a debate because people don't listen. And you've got to try and establish some boundaries, some standards, some rules of evidence. What I'm going to suggest to you is the rules I'm using here, as we'll see as we go through this, that these are good rules to have. You may feel free to disagree because there will be time to question all of this. So let's just come on to this passage that we read in Acts chapter 1. It's a fascinating thing. If you look at the beginning of the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts, of course, they're written by the same person. Now, what's important is most people would regard the Bible's documents just casually. They would just simply say that they are the equivalent of there was a hobbit that lived in a hole, or once upon a time. In other words, fairy story and myth. The trouble is, if you actually examine the text and the detail, and you don't even need to really know the detail, just the basic text, you will find that they are not written like that. You cannot put them as that kind of genre. They are written as historical documents. They are also written as evidential documents, particularly these two. So, yeah, you'll find the beginning of Luke. In order to establish proof, you've got to have careful investigation. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those from the first, who were the first eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Now, what's interesting about that is you immediately draw from that, first of all, that actually many people tried to write about this or draw up an oral account. Secondly, that a lot of information was handed down. Now, you may regard information as handed down as hearsay. I want to say that is not the case. So, for example, are you seriously going to argue there is no indigenous culture in Australia because you do not have written sources? In an oral culture, many things are handed down. I find it very interesting that, sorry to use Brexit as an illustration again, but the UK government at this moment in time, the EU are saying we have no written proposals. Well, that's obvious. And the reason for that is simple. As soon as a proposal is written, it's going to be leaked to somebody. So everything is being done kind of almost secretly and orally. Does that negate the oral? If someone was to say, as a witness, I heard the Prime Minister say this, because it's not written down, does that mean the evidence? Also, by the way, let me do it the other way. Because it is written down, when someone says, I read it somewhere, it doesn't mean it's true. You know, if you say, I read it in the Australian or I read it in the Herald, therefore it must be true, depending on your political prejudice. You write something down. It may look impressive, but it may not be true. But what Luke does here, he's saying, I carefully investigated. Now, what's interesting in the name Theophilus is that's a Roman name in a Jewish-Palestinian context. And it's a name that implies that he was a Roman official, possibly even a procurator of some kind. Luke is deliberately saying, you're a man who likes evidence. I've investigated this. And look what he says about it. I've carefully investigated. And also what he says, everything from the beginning. So he's gone into some depth. A lot of us, I meet lots of people who say, I disagree with you and I can prove this. And all they've done is Googled. So everyone thinks they know everything because they've got a smartphone that they can Google up and they come up with a fact, or except it's not a fact. So they miss out context. They miss out lots of things. What Luke does here is he investigates. He's saying he's investigated everything. And he's writing out an orderly account. And again, what he's presupposing is that people are logical. They are logikos, that they can think things through reasonably. And again, I don't think that that is restricted to academics. I think you present your case, and it should be a logical case. It should be that there's a point that leads to another point that leads to another point. If you just randomly, if you as a lawyer were just randomly throw out facts and not bring them to a conclusion, a logical conclusion, then you probably deserve to be fired and should go get a job doing something else. It's a logical position that he's saying. And notice his purpose, that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. How can you be certain about things? I know that there are people who think it's very humble to say, well, you can never be... let me put this another way. There are people who know everything and are certain about everything, right? You just need to ignore them. But there are other people who go, well, we can know nothing. I find that, for example, in the argument when we discuss the existence of God or whatever, you'll get people say, I'm agnostic. And there are two kinds of agnostic. There are intelligent agnostics and there are stupid agnostics. And having set it up like that, I ask, which one do you want to be? The stupid agnostic is the one who says, we don't know and we can't know. Well, how do you know that you can't know? You have to investigate. You have to find out. The intelligent agnostic is the one who says, I don't know, but I'd like to find out. I'd like to investigate. And it seems to me that there are some things in life that are worth investigating, and there are other things that are not. I think life, death, heaven, hell, God, whatever, that's got to be worth investigating because there are enormous consequences either way. So that's the situation in terms of what Luke tries to do. And I think he does it remarkably well, both in his gospel. His gospel is part one. The Acts, often subtitled Acts of the Apostles, though probably better to say Acts of the Holy Spirit, you'll see that he continues. Notice again here, I wrote about all that Jesus began to do and teach. And again, when you're examining a document, you look at the language very carefully. Because I think also, you gentlemen and ladies will appreciate this. In law, language is very important. Tense is important. Meaning of words is important. And here Luke says, and he knows what he's doing, Jesus began to do and teach, but he's finished with Jesus' death. He starts this chapter with Jesus ascending into heaven. But what he's really saying is the work of Jesus continued on. And that's a hugely significant thing in terms of the evidence. Verse 3 is the one that I want you to really think about. After his suffering, he presented himself to them and gave many convincing proofs he was alive. Now, again, think about who's saying this, because he's a doctor. He knows that dead people do not rise. And he's saying that this man, Jesus, gave many convincing proofs that he was alive. So I want to look at this just briefly in terms of the evidence. He's saying there's many convincing proofs. Evidence occurs in this way. First of all, authentication. Now, my view is that we are getting into deeper trouble in our culture because we're moving away from objective standards of proof to feeling. So when you get a politician, you say, oh, he's so authentic. We had a guy called Tony Blair, and he just specialized in being authentic. You know, and I'm not making a political point, but he's one of the best liars ever. In fact, the best liars are really authentic. They come across as authentic. I think that, if you have to wear a T-shirt saying, I'm authentic, or if you're a lawyer standing up before a judge and you say, look, I'm really an honest lawyer, you're pretty well going to lose your case straight away. If you have to present the case about your own character, authentic doesn't mean that he came across as authentic or that he seemed like a nice guy. Because here's the problem, by the way. I made a remark a week ago suggesting that in law, you know, if you have one witness against another, it wasn't sufficient. I was told, you may be correcting me, I was told by a lawyer that that is no longer the case in Australia. And that you can have one witness against another, and it's whoever the judge believes. I think that's a very, very dangerous precedent. Because you could have someone present themselves as being, you know, they could come across really well. They could look good. They could sound good. You could empathize with them. And you could have someone like me who would come across really badly. And you say, oh, I don't like him. He's ugly. He must be wrong or something. And the danger is that we go by impressions. Authentic does not mean impressions. It's not, well, I kind of feel that Jesus is kind of, you know, he's the kind of guy I would like. Because what you end up doing is you end up creating somebody in your own image or what you would like. That's not what authentic means. Authentic, I would argue, is for real. And there are different standards. One is self-authentication. And that's what Luke is speaking about here. He's saying Jesus presented many proofs that he was alive. Now, what's fascinating about that is that he needed to. This is not people saying, we were so desperate to believe he was alive that this ghost appeared and then we went for it. There's little details, like in Luke's gospel, Luke talks about how Jesus sat down and ate some broiled fish. And he says, look, A ghost doesn't eat broiled fish. I've always thought if I was a fishmonger, that's the text I would have up in my shop. Jesus ate broiled fish, you should too. And then you'd get all the religious people. And I would say, have a special deal for Catholics on a Friday. And for, you know, I'd do Protestants another day and, you know, charismatics every day and whatever. You know, that's I would work with those kind of things. Baptists, I would say these fish have been fully baptized. I would go the whole hog with all of that. But I love that detail. I love the detail that Jesus ate broiled fish. I'm sorry, but I'm a historian. And it's the details in history that make it real. And that's one of the things here. There's a self-authentication. He needed to. Thomas, I'm not going to believe, he said. I don't care what the rest of you say. I'm not going to believe unless I can put my finger in the holes in his hands. And then Jesus appeared and he freaked out. Thomas freaked out. You know, and then recognized and called him my Lord and my God. So there's another time that Jesus appeared to 500 people at the same time. What fascinates me about that is that in the year, we think it was around 125, there's a man called Quadratus who writes a letter to the emperor and says there are many people who saw Jesus alive after he'd been crucified, and he said some of these people are still alive. Now, why is that important? Because he's making a truth claim which he says can be authenticated or falsified. You know, that's a basic principle of science, of course, that if you cannot falsify it, you cannot claim it to be science. The whole thing about science is not that it's true, but that it can be falsifiable. If it's not falsifiable, you cannot prove or disprove. And when he says there are many people who are still alive, writing to the emperor, all the emperor has to do is say, prove it. Give me some of them. It's like there was this crazy American evangelist called Todd Bentley. And I mean, he is crazy. I'm sorry, I'm a Christian, but he's completely crazy. He used to talk about how he raised people from the dead. And he was challenged to prove it. And he said, you know, we've got 15 authentic testimonies. And he said, he was told, name them. And it's one of my favorite lines ever. It could have come out of a Monty Python sketch. He said, well, we can't name them because of health and safety and confidentiality reasons. I'm going, you raise them from the dead and you're worried about health and safety? You know, but, you know, I was just utterly wacko. Now, that's the same thing. If you're making a claim that you're asking other people to believe, it has much more credence if it is falsifiable. And that's what Quadratus did in his letter. That also, by the way, is what Luke is doing here. Another aspect of evidence is hearsay. Now, generally, as a principle of law, hearsay is not admissible. But there are exceptions to that. In fact, there are a considerable number of exceptions to it, and you would be able to tell me more than I can. But there are a significant number of exceptions. And part of it, hearsay by itself does not prove anything, but it may hint at something, it may point at something. So, for example, I remember a Chinese communist lady coming to my church in Scotland, never been in a church, never read the Bible. She actually came to our house and had a Christmas meal with us. And she said, I want to find out more about what Christianity is and who Jesus is. And I said, why? She said, because I've heard a bit about it. I've heard this. I've heard that. It was kind of hearsay. But she wanted to examine the evidence. And there's an extent to which hearsay can set us on a particular path of inquiry. I would argue that whilst hearsay is not absolute proof or sufficient proof even, It can be helpful in us thinking about things. And then there's the direct circumstantial stuff. This is like teaching your grandmother to suck eggs. I don't know if any of your grandmothers did suck eggs, but you know the phrase. But let me just explain, just in case any of you are not lawyers, what's the difference between direct and circumstantial evidence? Direct evidence is when one of you comes in off the street and you tell me just now, it's raining. So you're giving me direct evidence. Circumstantial evidence is you come in off the street, you don't speak to me, but I notice you've got a wet brolly. I'm guessing that someone didn't waterbomb you. I'm guessing that, you know, there wasn't a giant seagull did something. What I'm suggesting is it's raining outside because I can observe it. That's circumstantial evidence. What's presented in both the Gospels and in Acts is direct evidence, and also circumstantial evidence. And the circumstantial evidence continues beyond that. So let me give you just a couple of examples. The direct evidence is the evidence of the witnesses. So Luke is saying, I have interviewed these people. There's a book by a professor from St. Andrews University called Richard Bauckham called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. And I think from a historical point of view, in my view anyway, he sufficiently proves that the Gospels were written by people who were either eyewitnesses themselves or interviewed the eyewitnesses. So that's the direct evidence. The circumstantial is this. Let's take something like the actual resurrection. So you say, okay, that didn't happen because dead people don't rise. Well, philosophically, that's a circular argument, which I think it's unwise to make. I think what you can say is, normally dead people don't rise. But this is a claim that this is absolutely exceptional, which proves the exceptional. But you might want to explain why the tomb was empty, or you might want to say, well, the disciples stole the body. But then you've got circumstantial evidence, because we know this, that several of the disciples were killed because they said that Jesus was alive. Who of us would die because of a lie? So you can build up a whole range of evidence that is circumstantial. You can look at motivation. You can look at what happened. You can look at what developed. And so I actually wrote a book of evidence for Jesus in that Peter was referring to that he read. I'm really disappointed that he hadn't read it a long time ago, you know, but it's okay. I'm going to quiz him about it at some point. And one of that is, one of the circumstantial evidence is the continued existence of the church. Now, why do I say that? Because in the first century, there were numerous groups and cults and religious groups. Why did Christianity survive? Was it because they were more powerful? Not at all. Cleverer? Probably not. And Augustine describes it this way. We have three incredibles, all of which have yet come to pass. It is incredible that Jesus Christ should have risen in the flesh and ascended with flesh into heaven. It is incredible that the world should have believed so incredible a thing. And it is incredible that a very few men of mean birth and the lowest rank and no education should have been able so effectually to persuade the world and even its learned men of such an incredible thing. In other words, the argument that's being used is that the idea of the gospel of Jesus Christ is so incredible that it might actually be true. And for me, I find that an interesting thought. Okay, I'm going to leave it there and leave some time for questions, except for this one thing. You can investigate something, At some point, you have to come to a verdict. You know, I guess you could ask for a retrial. You just can't keep having retrials. And John, in his gospel, says why he did. Now, John 20 is the account of the resurrection. And he says this, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. At some point, you have to make a decision. And here's the bad news for you. It is like you are judge and jury. When you are presented with the truth of Jesus Christ, you have to decide whether it's the truth or not. What you cannot do is walk away and say, I didn't know, or I wasn't asked to decide. Well, you do know, and you are asked to decide. My view is that any intelligent person, any rational person, would want to say, okay, I'm not saying I necessarily believe that, but I will investigate it. And for me, that's what I would argue. I would say to those of you who are Christians, you have to keep on looking at the evidence. You know, the idea of, I just believe because I believe because I believe. I'm sorry, that's not right. I'm not suggesting that you go around saying, well, I don't know if I believe this, I don't know if I believe that. All I'm saying is that there is a phenomenal amount of evidence and you need to think it all through, not least for yourself, but also for other people that you will meet. You'll notice that I missed one, and that was the witnesses, but that's what we're going to do next week. So thank you. Okay. All right, let's do these. We'll do these very quickly. I love the first one. Many people, Christians and non-Christians, get involved in debates online or otherwise, and their anger levels increases, as does frustration, sadness, and despair at the state of society, culture, the church. How can we get involved in these debates without them stealing our pleasure and joy in life? Personally, I recommend execution. No. I just say to people, look, I'm right. So just accept it. Get over it, snowflake. Now move on. My serious advice in that one is online debates, don't get involved in them, says he, a complete hypocrite, having come in on the train today, texting people like tweeting people like mad. Don't get involved in them unless you're desiring to provoke and you're say, look, let's not talk about this anymore on the internet because we can't get it right. Come and meet me for a coffee or do something. That's what I would suggest. I used to have a cartoon on my wall, which was a guy sitting at a computer desk shouting up to his wife, I can't come to bed yet, dear. There's someone wrong on the internet. There's always going to be someone wrong on the internet and you can't sort them. The ascension is only described in the Acts of the Apostles and not in the Gospels. Why? Because part one, part two. It's a bit like, in fact, there's also a part three. If you look at the end of the Gospel of Acts, it's a really pathetic ending because it's not the end. It's a bit like the TV series 24. You finish one program and you immediately want to see the next one because that's how they set it up. And I think that's how the Gospels are set up. Did the gospel writers consider that was not a very important part of Jesus' life? You're kidding. They witnessed it. For them, the fact that he was coming again. Or did they have limited writing material? No. They knew, they witnessed, they saw it. If the evidence for Christianity is so strong, why is Christianity on the back foot in our country? Well, basically because Australians don't examine evidence. Not just Australians, but most people. And most people judge things by prejudice. And Christianity has always been on the back foot. And it's not just about evidence, is it? It's about emotion. It's about prejudice. It's about culture. And also, I would suggest that far too many Christians and churches have given up on the idea of presenting evidence. Or we presented it in a cold and calculating way, which is really wrong. What evidences are about Jesus from non-Christian sources? Actually, a considerable amount. Tacitus, the Roman historian, Josephus, the Jewish historian. Here's the amazing thing as a historian, for me. Jesus was a first century Palestinian peasant. History is not written about or by peasants. And yet, we have Jesus being mentioned all over the place within 100 years of his death, which you may think is a long time, but in historical terms is a tiny amount of time. No really serious historian would doubt the existence of Jesus. It's only in the age of the internet where people become experts through Wikipedia that you get people saying, oh, well, Jesus didn't exist. To me, that's like Holocaust denial. It's not worth debating. If you can be healed miraculously, how can a man not be raised from the dead? I would say you can be raised from the dead in the sense of the point about being raised from the dead is it doesn't happen. If the gospel was Jesus was really sick and then he got better, now you need to believe he's the Son of God, it's not much of a gospel. But it's precisely because people do not rise from the dead. So the Apostle Paul, when he was in Athens, he spoke about a lot of different things. It's only when he got to the bit saying Jesus was raised from the dead that the philosophers and the Stoics and the Epicureans and the politicians all said, oh, forget it. We're not listening to this guy. You know, Paul sometimes wasn't a very successful preacher. He spoke to all these people and just a handful of them believed. His mission in Athens didn't work too well. And that's because they just said, well, we don't accept this. Has Cardinal George Pell been found guilty beyond reasonable doubt? I haven't a clue. I'll leave you guys to decide that. If a young guy stabs people in the street shouting Allah Akbar and people say he's not a terrorist, what is the point of evidence? Well, terrorist is a description. One man's terrorist, another man's freedom fighter. When Begin blew up the British, the Grand Hotel in Jerusalem and killed 120 people, was he a terrorist or a freedom fighter? Well, it's your perspective. It's both. If someone goes and stabs someone, and you can shout Allah Akbar, by the way, because you're mentally ill, not because you're an organized terrorist. There are a whole range of different things. I think you need to be really, really careful to try and avoid both kinds of prejudice. So I happen to think, for example, that there is Islamic terrorism, but that doesn't mean that my neighbors next door who are Muslims are terrorists or support terrorism. Is the coming of Jesus at the time that he came at the intersection of the Greek and Roman world given his life, as recorded in the Bible, some form of divine intervention of revelation into human reasoning. I mean, in the sense of a God comprehensible in history. Yes. The answer to that is yes. It's his story. It was just the right time. It was when there was, in effect, one, dare I say it, lingua franca, which the French won't like, which actually was Greek, not Latin. And it's highly probable that Jesus and the disciples would at least have known some Greek. Was Luke aware of the Jewish scriptures? Yes, especially the Jewish recording of their historical involvement with God. Of course he was. Luke was a Jew. Luke 1:3, after Jesus' suffering, not the cross, was a language or the shame of the cross? No, because the suffering of Jesus was throughout his life. And he's not just limiting it to the cross. It accumulates in the cross. But he sweated, as it were, drops of blood in the Garden of Gethsemane. He was rejected by people and so on. What level of proof should be required to be satisfied Christ rose from the dead? Sufficient. Beyond reasonable doubt, balance of probabilities, or some other test. I would go beyond reasonable doubt, personally. Circumstantial evidence. Does the survival resurgence of Hinduism in India suggest that the religion is also true? No, it suggests that there is a political party come to power which is appealing to ethnic nationalism. I saw at the bottom of your PowerPoint the words third space. What is that? Well, watch this space. I'll tell you next week. It's basically here. It's to allow people to discuss things and question things in a non-confrontational manner. And I try. Is there still an abuse of law that withholds evidence using law, avoiding grace and truth, causing injustice despite convincing proofs? Not sure I completely understand that. I would say, yes, there is an abuse that occurs in this. Here is the big error, and this is a good one for me, I think, to finish with. The trouble with law is, and making a judgment on this, is none of us is impartial. None of us. We all have histories, prejudices, and everything. And it's really hard for us to detach ourselves from that. And I think the only way that you can make judgments is if you recognize that you are not the judge, you are not the truth, and you have a certain degree of humility. So all the judgments we make are based upon a recognition of our limitations. And at some point, you are making a decision. And the only illustration I'll give is this. You're a young guy, and you're deciding whether you want to get married to the girl you've been going out with. Now, if you are a cold and calculating lawyer, which none of you are, you sit down, you work out the cost benefit. You work out whether there's proof that you love her or she loves you. What's going to happen in 10 years time? You play the Beatles when I'm 64 and then project yourself into the, and you spend all your time calculating about whether it's going to work. As a result, for the next 50 years, you never get around to proposing to anyone because you just can't make a decision. At some point, you've got to say, I have sufficient evidence that suggests that I love this girl, that we could be together, that we could go through the ups and downs of life. I cannot guarantee the future, but I can commit myself to her. And I would say that's exactly the same with faith in Jesus Christ. At some point, you say, enough. I've got enough. I'm prepared to commit to follow him. Ironically, when you do that, you then get much more evidence. But until you make that step, that's not blind faith because you're basing it on some evidence, but until you make that, you're stuck in the valley of indecision. And the Bible talks about the valley of decision. At some point, you have to say yes or no. And that's what I encourage you to do. So thank you so much for your patience. I didn't apologize for my accent this time because I've been in Australia for 2 years and I know Aussie. Yeah, 2 weeks, 2 months. 2 months, yeah, sorry. What's that? I'll go quickly then, okay.
We're talking about facts and circumstances. Nobody actually saw him get up out of the grave. So if we're talking about balance of probabilities versus beyond reasonable doubt, is that a hole in the argument?
No, because you should know by now that sight is an incredible thing. You can see things that don't exist, and you can not see things that do exist. When someone says, I saw this, so for example, I mentioned I was seriously ill. Well, I also became seriously delusional. And I saw things like, you know, I saw that we were on a ship. I saw that I was the king of Norway. You know, you can see things that are not real. And so the seeing and not seeing is not really the key thing. Seeing that someone is dead, then meeting them alive, there's an obvious logical conclusion. There is no other thing that you can say. Now, you can argue they weren't really dead. You can argue they weren't really alive. But you cannot say, because you can't say, I saw him dead, I saw him alive, because I didn't see him rise, therefore he cannot have done so. I mean, I didn't see you born, but I have a pretty strong hunch that you were actually born. You know, yeah. I mean, you could have come down from Mars, but, you know, I'm working on the assumption that there was a birth canal process involved at some point in your life.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.